Today is November the 25th, and this is Kathy bringing you the second half of the Decatur Herald Reading Review. Some national news. U.S. traffic deaths rise sharply after a small decline in 2014. From Detroit. After declining for most of the past decade, traffic deaths spiked 8% in the first half of this year, prompting a call from the nation's highway safety chief to find ways to reduce human errors that cause most fatalities. The new estimate released Tuesday by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration comes just as millions of Americans prepare to hit the road for the Thanksgiving holiday. AAA predicts that 42 million people will drive 50 miles or more over the coming weekend. Officials released a final number of fatal crashes for 2014, which showed a decline of 0.1%. This year, lower gas prices and an improving economy are prompting people to travel more. Americans drove 1.54 trillion miles in the first half of 2015, up 3.5% from the same period in 2014, according to the Federal Highway Administration. But NHTSA Administrator Mark Rosekind said that not all of the increase could be attributed to people driving more miles. He suspects that texting and other distractions while using smartphones was part of the case, as well as drunken, drugged, and drowsy driving, and increased driving by teenagers. NHTSA, he said, does not have clear enough data yet to pinpoint exact causes. These numbers are a wake-up call, Rosekind said of the increase. He urged people to stop using their phones while driving, not to drink alcohol or use drugs, and get behind the wheel, and to wear seat belts and motorcycle helmets. NHTSA said its research shows that human decisions cause 94% of all crashes. The agency plans to hold 5 meetings around the country early next year to get input on how to cut traffic deaths, followed by a larger meeting in Washington that would yield recommendations to address human factors. It is important for Americans to know that human behaviors are by far the largest cause of fatalities, Rosekind said. Rosekind said that 2014 statistics show that distracted driving caused about 10% of the 32,675 traffic deaths that year, but he said that since driver distraction is difficult to track, our numbers underestimated exactly what's going on out there. The slight drop in 2014 traffic deaths came after a decade that saw a 25% decline due to fewer miles driven, safer cars, and public awareness of the dangers of drunken driving. For 2014, the rate of fatalities fell to a record low of 1.07 deaths per million vehicle miles traveled. But Rosekind said 2015 estimates showed the death rate rising over 4%, which he called troubling. NHTSA's numbers showed that 2014 was the safest year on record for people inside vehicles, with 21,022 deaths reported. Nearly half of those killed were not wearing seat belts, even though seat belt use rose to 87%, Rosekind said. Bicyclist deaths declined 2.3% last year, but pedestrian fatalities rose 3.1% over 2013. Both appear to be rising slightly this year, Rosekind said. Drunken driving continued to cause about one-third of all traffic deaths in 2014, with 9,967 people killed. The safety agency will hold meetings in February and March in Sacramento, California, Boston, Denver, Atlanta, and Dallas-Fort Worth to get input. After that, safety experts will meet in Washington, D.C. to come up with an action plan, Rosekind said. The plan will focus on human errors or choices that cause crashes, Rosekind said, adding that there is excitement over new technologies that can prevent some of those mistakes. U.S. officials signal move toward embracing self-driving cars. Federal transportation officials are rethinking their position on self-driving cars with an eye toward getting the emerging technology into the public's hands. Just 2 years ago, the U.S. Department of Transportation struck a cautious tone. Its official policy statement, published in May 2013, says cars should be limited to testing and not authorized for use by members of the public for general driving purposes, unquote. With the technology's rapid development, that federal policy is being updated, Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox said Tuesday. I want the posture of our agency to be obviously vigilant on the safety front, but I don't want our agency to be skittish about innovations that are out there, Fox said. It's unclear what the new policy will be, but Fox clearly signaled that the technology intrigues him. He told reporters that he hoped the update overseen by his department's National Highway Safety Traffic Administration would be ready in weeks, not months. For several years, Google and a handful of automakers, including Tesla Motors, Nissan, and Honda, have been testing prototypes equipped with a suite of sensors and cameras on public streets and highways, mostly in California. Those cars must have someone behind the wheel ready to take over. Some have gotten into collisions, though in each case, the companies say a person in another car caused the accident. Google has advocated getting self-driving cars into the public domain as quickly as possible once the technician concludes the technology is safe. While states have taken the lead on regulating self-driving cars, policymakers in Washington hold indirect sway over states' decision-making. California's Department of Motor Vehicles, in particular, has sought federal guidance as it struggles with how to move the cars safely from small-scale road tests to broader adoption. Language that the federal government is revisiting specifies that in states where the public can get access to the cars, a licensed driver should be up behind the wheel. Google sees that as unnecessary. It has argued that once cars can drive as safely as humans, it would be better to remove the steering wheel and pedals so that people don't mess up the ride. A Google spokesman had no comment on the word of the federal review. The California State Transportation Agency has interpreted the 2013 federal guidance as urging caution. The federal update, quote, reaffirms that the topic is evolving and one worthy of continued discussion and public input, unquote, spokeswoman Melissa Figueroa said. The Department of Motor Vehicles is working to publish draft regulations by year's end, Figueroa said. The draft was due last January 1st, but concerns such as proving that technology is safe has held those rules. The nonprofit group Consumer Watchdog has been advocating restraint. The California DMV correctly is focused on getting the regulations correct rather than rushing them out the door, John Simpson of Consumer Watchdog said in a written statement Tuesday. Federal authorities must not succumb to corporate pressure to move so fast that our safety on the highways is compromised, end of quote. And an editorial which reads, Open Government Equals Better Government. A new study by the Center for Public Integrity confirms what most Illinois residents already knew. The state has a real and deep governmental ethics problem. The center gave the state a D+ on integrity in its latest set of scores. The state's scores actually place it in 16th in the country, and the center is no easy grader. Only three states earned greater than a D+. But the well-publicized scandals that have placed two of the last three governors, a Congress member and his wife, and several other politicians in prison, are only part of the problem, according to this study. The state has more fundamental and deeper problem that revolves around a lack of transparency in state government. Illinois received an F grade in the following areas: public access to information, executive accountability, judicial accountability, state budget process, state civil service management, and ethics enforcement agencies. The highest award the state received was in pension fund management. That seems unusual, but the grades were based on the pension management process and not whether the pensions were adequately funded. The biggest problem, according to the study and other experts, is that the public simply can't access the information necessary to keep an eye on what governmental officials are doing. It is simply too easy for public officials to keep information away from the public and to keep the public out of important meetings. For example, the General Assembly has excused itself from many of the open meetings and open records laws. The annual budget process, when there is one, is a good example. The budget is usually constructed in a series of secret meetings between political leaders and then handed to the rank and file to vote on before the plan can be vetted or, in most cases, even read. Even when it's complete, there are few, if any, people in the state that can unravel the state budget because of the shifting of funds in and out of the general fund and other special funds. It's a system that at best is confusing. At its worst, it's an attempt to obscure what's really happening. This lack of public scrutiny leads directly to corruption and unethical behavior. Illinois residents have been subjected to this behavior for so long that they are complacent about all but the most dramatic cases. A lot of politicians, including Governor Bruce Rauner, have gone to Springfield saying they want to change the way state government operates. A good start would be to shine some light on how the government operates by advocating meaningful open records and open meetings reform. That was an editorial from the board of the Herald and Review. And a couple of letters to the editor. Tobacco quitline funds need to be protected. The American Cancer Society's Great American Smokeout was a day for people to create a plan to quit tobacco. One popular resource for those who want to quit is the Illinois Tobacco Quit Line. But as state budget talks continue to draw out, funding for this free, life-saving resource remains at risk. Tobacco use is the nation's most preventable cause of death, but it still claims thousands of lives every year right here in Illinois. Many of us have even watched our friends, family members, and neighbors lose their lives to smoking. That reality makes it even more important to protect funding for the Quit Line, which connects smokers with the support they need to break their addiction and has successfully led thousands of Illinoisans to quit for good. I personally know how difficult it is to quit this horrible addiction, so I understand just how important the Quit Line is to those who want to quit. Because the Quit Line is so successful, it saves the state money that would have been used to pay for health care expenses from tobacco use. And since the program is paid for through the Tobacco Master Settlement, an agreement that the tobacco industry will pay states $10 billion each year indefinitely, it doesn't cost taxpayers a cent. I urge our lawmakers to stand up for the health of our neighbors. Please join me in asking them to protect funding for the Illinois Tobacco Quit Line. And that is signed Radine Cox of Decatur. The next letter, honor the Statue of Liberty's meeting. It seems that a good number of our citizens are ready to pack up the Statue of Liberty and send it back to France, the country which presented it to the USA, as a gift worth $400,000 at that time. It is the statue that welcomed so many of our ancestors when they arrived in this blessed country as immigrants. But some persons no longer believe the message at the base of the statue, a poem written by Emma Lazarus, a Jewish American poet. Quote, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send them, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. I still honor the words of this poem. Do you? And that was written by Virginia McQuiston. And now I'd like to turn to the obituaries for today. Cook, Virginia Ann, from Decatur. Virginia Ann Cook, 77, formerly of Decatur, left us to see her Heavenly Father on Sunday, November 22nd, at her home in Gilman. Visitation will be held on Saturday, November 28th, from 9:30 a.m. until the 11 a.m. memorial service at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Gilman. Euler Bonnie. From Decatur, Bonnie Euler, 68, of rural Tremont, passed away on November 22nd at OSF Richard L. Owens Hospice Home in Peoria. Cremation rites have been accorded. A memorial service will be held at 3 p.m. Saturday, November 28th, at Tremont United Methodist Church. Pastor Dan Perry officiating. Visitation will be from 1 to 3 p.m. on Saturday, also at the church. Burial will be at Mount Hope Cemetery in Tremont. Davis Oswald Funeral Home is handling the arrangements. Memorials may be made to the Girl Scouts of Central Illinois or Tremont United Methodist Church. Bunch, Devon on Alandre. Devon Alandre Bunch, Jr., infant son of Raven Simone Starks and Devon Alandre Bunch, Sr., was placed in the loving arms of Jesus at 7:45 p.m. Friday, November 20th, at Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri. His family would like to give special thanks to Jennifer, Taisha, Kiana, Mary, the Ross family, Ty, and the NICU of Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Graveside services to celebrate the life of Devon Alandre Bunch, Jr. will be at 2 p.m. Wednesday, November 25th, in Graceland Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the NICU of Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital, 1465 South Grand Boulevard, St. Louis, Missouri. Lil Sidney L., the Sidney L. Lil of Forsyth, 67, passed away Sunday, November 22nd, in his home, surrounded by his family. The family will host a visitation from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Friday, November 27, 2015, at the Elwin United Methodist Church. Military rites will be performed at 11 a.m., followed by a memorial service. In lieu of flowers, memorials are suggested to the University of Chicago Cancer Research Foundation, 5841 South Maryland Avenue, MC 1140, Chicago, Illinois, 60637. Cremation services will be provided by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home Cemeteries and Cremation Center. O'Bannon Michael. From Decatur, Michael O'Bannon peacefully passed away in his sleep at home. He was preceded in death by his father, Sammy O'Bannon. Services celebrating his life will be held at 12 noon Friday, November 27th at the Main Street Church of the Living God, with visitation 1 hour before service. Burial, Graceland Cemetery, professional services entrusted to Walker Funeral Service. Bricky Allen D. Jr. from Iliopolis. Allen D. Bricky Jr., 72, of Iliopolis, died on Saturday, November 21, 2015, at his residence. Visitation will be from 9 a.m. until the time of the funeral service at 12 o'clock on Friday, November 27, at Fullenwider Park Funeral Home in Iliopolis, with Chaplain Linda Blakeman officiating. Burial will follow at Taylor Cemetery in Spalding. Memorial contributions may be made to the Iliopolis Summer Recreation Program or the Iliopolis Food Pantry. Vaughn Georgette E. from Latham. Georgette E. Vaughn, 94, passed away at 7:08 p.m. on November 18th at Vanderleith Living Center in Mount Pulaski. Georgette was born on March 2nd, 1921, in Ghent, Belgium. Services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 28th, at the Freaky Calvert Schrader Funeral Home in Mount Pulaski, with Reverend Jeffrey Label officiating. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will be at the 2 Mile Grove Cemetery, rural Latham, following the service. Memorials may be made to the American Heart Association or the American Diabetes Association. Emil Robert Stanley. Robert Stanley Emil, age 83, of Sullivan, passed away at 12:30 a.m. Tuesday, November 24th at home, surrounded by his family. A reception for family and friends will be held from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Friday, November 27th, at the Reed Funeral Home in Sullivan. Private family services will be a later date. Memorials are suggested to the Sullivan First Christian Church or Habitat for Humanity. Online condolences may be sent to the family at reedfuneralhome.net. Schroeder, Donald Henry. Donald Henry Schroeder, 87, of Monticello, passed away at 4:35 p.m. November 22nd at his residence. Visitation will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, November 27th at the Christ Lutheran Church, 779 East Old Route 47 in Monticello, Illinois. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 28th at 2015 at Christ Lutheran Church with Pastor Micah Garnett and Pastor Ethan Feisner officiating. Interment will be held in the Monticello Township Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be made to Carl Hospice, American Heart Association, or Christ Lutheran Church. And that's all the obituaries we have for today. We will try to catch up on the weekend's obituaries on Monday, but there will be no readings on Thursday or Friday. Now from one of the columns, and this is a Solutions for Stains on Shirts and Windows by Mary Hunt. Dear Mary, my husband wears white undershirts, and no matter what brand or fabric content, they get gray blotches in the wash. I typically use non-chlorine bleach and fabric softener, but recently stopped those additions and that didn't help. I use high-efficiency detergent. The washer is set to whites and dryer to cottons. I changed detergent brands and switched from powder to liquid, but still the blotches appear. I wash my white t-shirts in the same load as his undershirts, and mine come out fine. Any suggestions on why these blotches appear, how to remove existing ones, and how to avoid them in the future will be much appreciated. From Mona. Dear Mona, the pattern and location of the stains in your photo leads me to believe this is not a detergent problem. The culprit here is most likely perspiration. My best guess is that these blotches are caused by a reaction between urea, a broken down protein, and salts found in human perspiration, occurring in various degrees from one person to another. Yellowish armpit stains and white t-shirts are a sign of the same thing, sweat that has interacted with antiperspirant ingredients, causing these stains to show up yellow. If you've been washing these shirts in chlorine bleach, you're only making matters worse, but don't fret. You have several options regarding how to remove these stains and also to avoid new ones in the future. Soil Love, S-O-I-L-O-V-E. The easiest way to remove sweat stains is with a stain treatment like Soil Love, formulated to attack protein-based stains like grease, ink, beverage, food, grass, blood, and perspiration. Treat old stains and also treat sweaty areas on shirts before they have a chance to turn into stains. And you can treat the old stains with Soil Love as well. It's a remarkable product. Lemon Juice. Before washing, combine equal parts of lemon juice and water and scrub until the stain is gone. White vinegar. Add 2 tablespoons of white vinegar to 1 cup of water and apply it to the stain. Let it sit for 30 minutes before washing. Salt. Add 1 tablespoon of table salt to 1 cup of water. Sponge the solution into the stain until it's completely gone. Launder as usual. Baking soda. Combine 4 tablespoons of baking soda and 1/4 of a cup of water. Dab on the stain until it's gone, then wash. Ammonia. Dilute household ammonia with an equal amount of water and pour onto the stain. You don't need to let it sit before washing, just toss it in. Hydrogen peroxide. Dilute hydrogen peroxide with an equal amount of water, apply to the stain, and let it sit 30 minutes before washing. Don't use hydrogen peroxide on colors as it does have similar properties to bleach. Oh boy, you got lots of solutions for that one. Calcium deposits. Dear Mary, I have very hard water leaving calcium deposits all over my windows. I have tried white vinegar and that didn't help. CLR seemed to work, but only a little bit. I can't stand to look at my windows. Dear Rosa, most hard water spots and buildup sit on the surface of the glass in windows and shower doors and can easily be removed by using a mixture of vinegar and Blue Dawn dishwashing liquid. Since neither vinegar nor CLR, which stands for calcium lime and rust remover, have worked on your windows, this leads me to believe your situation is not typical. Most likely you have silica stains. Silica, which is found in all natural water in varying degrees, over time has bonded with the glass in your windows, causing them to appear etched. The good news is that you may be able to remove these silica stains yourself and bring your windows back to their original clean and sparkly condition, providing they have not become permanently damaged. Are you up for a challenge? What you need to remove fine silica that is bonded with glass is hydrofluoric acid, sold as Winsol Labs Crystal Clear 550 Glass Clearing Agent, available in quarts and gallons, starting at about $15 from CWC Supply. Hydrofluoric acid eats silica off the glass. It takes very little of this product to loosen and dissolve these stubborn deposits. The product directions are very specific. Make sure you read the entire label before getting started. And this is from the health, medical, and fitness section. Food restriction helps mice with kidney disease. Researchers at Mayo Clinic have found that a mild to moderate reduction in calories effectively prevents and reverses polycystic kidney disease in mice. The results appear online in the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology and could have implications for humans with the disease. Currently, there is no FDA-approved treatment, and the only thing that can be done is dialysis or renal transplantation, explains Dr. Eduardo Cini, anesthesiologist and researcher for Mayo Clinic's Robert and Arlene Kogod Center on Aging and lead author of the study. We have found that a very simple measure, like decreasing the amount of calories that are taken in, even by only 10%, can very significantly decrease the burden of this disease. Researchers say the finding is a critical step toward effective treatment for PKD, an inherited disorder in which clusters of cysts develop primarily within the kidneys. The National Kidney Foundation estimates that 600,000 individuals of the United States have PKD, the fourth leading cause of kidney failure. Mayo Clinic researchers found that food restriction without malnutrition in mouse models prevented the development of PKD, as well as decreased kidney inflammation, cellular injury, and fibrosis. While a 40% reduction in calories almost completely prevented or reversed PKD in mice, even 10% was enough to have positive effects. We don't know the impact in humans with polycystic kidney disease yet, says Dr. Cini. It is very likely, based on what we know in the animal models, that some mild restriction of calories could delay the disease in humans. And I'm not talking about cutting 40% of your calories, but something very mild, like 10%, which would mean not eating one dessert or not drinking some soda. According to Dr. Cini, additional studies to further understand the impact in animals and then in humans with PKD are needed. Dr. Cheney's team also seeks to discover which kind of calories, fat, sugar, or protein are best to eliminate, and whether medications or medication diet combination could be an effective treatment for PKD. VA Foster Program Offers a New Kind of Veterans Home by Donald Bradley. Morning coffee at the kitchen table. Rocky Riojas, 93, sits at one end, bronze star cap on head, World War II shrapnel in his leg, and he's telling how his son always comes to visit. At the other end of the table, Theodosia Mobley, 84, who fought in Korea, scoffs. He doesn't always come to visit. These two are what you'd expect in a new foster family, a little picking, a little sniping, but it's early. They are part of a new Veterans Affairs program that places military veterans in the homes of people willing to open a door, pretty much like the foster kid system. Most of these vets are old and alone. They have health problems and nowhere else to go other than a nursing facility, and they don't want to go there. That's how Riojas, who grew up in Midtown Kansas City, and Mobley, an Arkansas farm boy, two Americans who fought for their country and ended up alone after fourscore, came to share this breakfast table. The ranch house on a narrow residential street in southeast Kansas City is their home now, maybe their last. It's where they watched the World Series together. "I'm not going to tell you everything is peaches and cream," said homeowner and caregiver Julius Anderson. They both have some dementia, and they don't always see eye to eye. But we're doing okay. A polite man who has worked most of his life in residential senior care, Anderson, 48, refers to his new boarders as Mr. Rocky and Mr. Theodosia. Today, the plan is for Anderson and his lady friends to take the vets to a family's holiday gathering in Louisiana. "I've told my brothers and sisters all about them, and they're looking forward to meeting them," Anderson said. "They are family now, so this trip is important." "That's how it's supposed to work," says Lisa Foodham, manager of home-based primary care for the Kansas City VA. "Having a spare room is the easy part," Foodham said. "You have to open your home and your family." The Kansas City VA placed its first veteran in a military foster home a year ago. This has been the learning period. They say it works. At last report, the Kansas City VA had placed 5 veterans in homes around the city. "This is a whole lot better than when I used to visit my mom in a nursing home," said Rioja's son, Rocky Jr. "It's a lot more like home. His memory's not good, but he seems to be doing so much better, and he's only been here for 3 months. The foster program is administered through the VA, but the veteran is responsible for his care, which ranges from $1,600 to $3,000 monthly for the caregiver, depending on the level of care needed. Now comes the push for more hosts for more vets. "It's not for everyone," Foodham acknowledged. "Most of us are private about our homes. I don't have a vet living with me. Margaret Cox does. Brian Lalone, a Marine back in the 1970s, came to her house in rural Bates City, Missouri in August. They say they found each other. Cox says her years as a Navy wife were the best of her life. She loved living on base, loved the camaraderie. But that all ended along with her marriage. To be honest, I was lonely," Cox said. "I'm 73, and a friend who was an Army nurse told me I should volunteer for the foster program. I wanted to do something for somebody who can't do for themselves. That's how I met Brian. He, 59, way overweight, and I'm a vegetarian. We walk every day and do our exercises. I love his mother. I take him to her house every Friday. Lalone suffers sleep apnea, diabetes, and heart failure. He had been living in a nursing home. He didn't know what to think when someone suggested he go to one of the new foster homes. It sounded good if it would get me out of the nursing home," he said in the dining room of Cox's home. "But foster homes sounded kind of weird, too. Is somebody going to adopt me?" He chuckled. "Nursing homes would be easier and more convenient than the new foster homes," Foodham agrees. "But it isn't human," she said. "Institutional living simply isn't how people want to live," she said. "Often 2 to a room and on strict schedules. Seniors tend to fight that arrangement as long as they can. But too often comes that time when they are living alone, begin to fall, and stop paying monthly bills. And we also know that I'm never leaving is an irrational stance," Foodham said. So a few years back, the VA started developing a model for the Veterans Medical Foster Home Program. Simply put, a home-like setting, warm and caring, where veterans can live out their years. Here's how it works. A veteran must be enrolled in VA health care and have needs that can no longer be met at home. The prospective homes are inspected and must be approved by the VA. The home must be able to provide 24/7 medical care, either by the trained caregiver or a backup. While in the home, the veteran will be monitored by a VA home-based primary care team that includes a doctor, a nurse practitioner, nurse, social worker, psychologist, occupational therapist, dietitian, and pharmacist. "And it's a lot more socialized," said Terry Curry, VA foster home coordinator for Kansas City. "We see lots of vets going to church, shopping, even vacation." Cox plans on taking Lalone with her to visit family in Florida. As Anderson fixed breakfast, Riojas and Mobley told about their years in the service. No boasts, just a couple of guys who got drafted and found themselves in a war. Both men like to ride in the car, and Anderson obliges with weekend drives. "They don't remember it later, but they knew it at the time," Anderson said. 3 days a week, he takes Riojas and Mobley to adult daycare. While they are there, Anderson works a part-time job in which he makes home checks on other veterans. Why does he do this to open up his home? Both of his parents died young, his father of cancer and his mother of a heart attack. And we need to stop that right there. And this is the end of the second half of the Herald and Review for today, which is Wednesday, November the 25th. You have a happy Thanksgiving, and this is Kathy signing off.